Today we have an exceptional IMAI seminar on Tuesday at 5 p.m. Because we have a visiting fellow here in IMAI, and it's Naya Kleist. She's a senior researcher at the Danish Institute for International Studies, and she did a PhD in sociology mainly, but she's focusing on deportation, return migration, of say diaspora as well. And today she will present hope and uncertainty in African migration life after deportation to Ghana. And after, so the seminar should take approximately an hour today, but we are quite flexible. And then you have a cocktail drink in the lobby, so we can go upstairs for the drink after that. So you have approximately half an hour, 40 minutes, and then you can engage discussion, and thank you for the presentation.
Thank you very much. It's really great to be here at IMAI. I'm enjoying that a lot and great to have this opportunity. I'm very pleased to see you and all friends and colleagues. So that's great. I'm going to apologize in advance if I start coughing wildly. I'm having a nasty cold and I cannot really control it, so you are warned about that. Anyway, today I'll speak about hope and uncertainty in African migration with a case study on life after deportation to Ghana. This work is part of a research program called New Geographies, Hope and Despair, the Social Effects of Migration Management for West African Migrants, which have been running since 2012 and which I am coordinating. It's a small program, we are just three persons. My two colleagues, Ida Rahman and daughter Thorsen, and we take departure in what could be called the contemporary mobility paradox. So this mobility paradox is that on the one hand, there are increased circulation of images of the good life, of migration, of globalization in social media, in global media, but also a lot in social relations which are circulating throughout the world. So if you have a smartphone, you can have direct access to images from all over the world. On the other hand, there's a high number of people who are excluded from the global circuits of legal migration because of migration management and restrictive mobility regimes in Europe and Africa and elsewhere. So this is not to say that there's less migration or more migration, but that migration is filtered, and for big parts of the population, say Africa, legal migration is quite difficult to access. So this mobility paradox made us ask some questions about what does the mobility paradox and restrictive mobility regimes mean for livelihoods, for mobility practices and for notions about the good life and future for West African migrants. And we have three case studies, which I'll just briefly mention. One set in transit zones, carried out by Dorben Thorsen from the University of Sussex in Rabat in Morocco, where she's been looking at labor and transit migration to Morocco. One in what would be termed an emerging destination, Senegalese migrants in Buenos Aires, Argentina, carried out by Ida Wangen, and then my case study on involuntary return to Ghana. And by involuntary return, I mean both deportation, but also other kinds of return. For instance, from the civil war in Libya, where migrants return empty-handed and before they planned to do it. So the focus in my research is more is on how people manage and perceive deportation and other forms of involuntary return, including remigration, and how they understand and perceive their future, and finally about tension between different notions of hope. My fieldwork was based in a rural town, not in Cape Coast, as you might have thought from the seminar poster. And I've been doing fieldwork there three times since 2012. What I'm going to do now today is first I'll talk a bit more about our approach in relation to hope, then very briefly introduce Ghanaian migration, and then talk about life after deportation to Ghana. So our work is inspired by and feeds into a broader interest in the future, hope and uncertainty, which seems to be blooming in anthropology and other social sciences in, like, say, the last 5-10 years. So there's specific interest in the future, with like books like Abel Ryan, The Future as a Cultural Effect, or Charles Piot and his Nostalgia for the Future. A lot of hope, a lot of work on hope in anthropology, and also an interest in uncertainty, like the books by edited by David Pratton and Cooper, and their special issue by Cindy Horst and Cassie Abramsky. When we look at the like more public or political level, hope has also been a key term in Obama's presidential campaign. The Pope has been talking about hope, so there's a lot of interest in this like overall notion. There's surprisingly little, though, when you look at mobility studies of mobility and migration, trying to link hope and mobility. Though there are exceptions, and there are, and there's work coming up. Our understanding of hope or our approach is as an analytical perspective, as a way of framing questions and asking certain questions. We understand hope as characterized by simultaneous potentiality and uncertainty of the future. So this means there's some degree of confidence and anticipation in the future, but also that it's always uncertain. It can never be completely certain if it is to be hope. And this also means that it has both individual and structural or collective dimensions, and that it's related to what Charles Taylor has called social imaginaries, and what is related to what is thinkable and imaginable. So our interest is to study what could be termed as the conditions of possibility for hope, how it's distributed, generated, broken, negotiated, perceived, etc., or what Steph Jackson has called the political economy of hope. We are inspired by Garson Hart's Lebanese Australian anthropologist, who has termed hope as a social category. He's not the first one, as Ramon just told me, but he talks about hope, social hope, as the way we construct a meaningful future for ourselves. He then distinguishes social hope from these like broad visions from societal hope. Societal hope is more delineated, and it consists of the visions of the good life and achievement within society. So how the state or politicians articulate narratives about the good life within a given society. And such visions may be related to upward mobility, say the old tale about being a newspaper boy who gets very rich in the States, or a computer science student, or whatever. And these narratives are then based on the belief, or they're trying to create this belief, that this may happen in spite of present difficulties and structural inequalities. So that also means that one can govern through hope, as my colleague Simon Turner has written about. And that hope and hopelessness is constituted and perceived within different contexts of fields. In relation to the spatial dimension of hope and hope and migration, we are particularly inspired by an anthropologist called Philip Marr, who has developed a term called the topography of hope, which relates to how hope or different notions of hope are kind of mapped or associated to different spaces and places, an idea that Henrik Nie, a Danish anthropologist, has also written about. So this is like our overall approach. One of the outputs of our work is an almost finished manuscript and edited volume to Routledge on hope and uncertainty in African migration. If all goes well, this will be sent in within just a very few weeks. And I'm not going to talk you through what we're going to do here or what we're doing, but just that it consists of case studies of mainly West African migration set both in Africa and countries of a region, neighboring countries further afield on the continent, and in new and established destinations. It's going to be one of those extremely, ridiculously expensive volumes, but it will come on a print-on-demand version in maybe 1.5-2 years. And what I will do for the rest of this talk is to talk about my chapter there on deportation to Ghana. So just to give you a little background on Ghanaian migration, there are about 1.5 to 2 million international Ghanaian migrants, nobody really knows. It's very mixed migration flows, ranging from highly skilled graduate students and researchers, doctors, etc., to low-skilled migrants, or also from very regularized migration to irregular migration. The large majority of Ghanaian migrants stay in West Africa, within the region, but there are also Ghanaians probably all over the whole world. But from a political perspective, there's mainly focus on Western countries. Ghanaian migrants send remittances, and there's also a lot of return visits for those who are staying a longer time abroad. Again, in terms of from the political context, educational and highly skilled migration is generally embraced and seen as having a development potential, whereas irregular migrants who are deported back to Ghana or get stuck are seen as embarrassments for the Ghanaian state, and their mobility as something which should be prevented, for instance, through information and educational campaigns, which are often funded by the EU or Western countries. And there are also strong narratives among Ghanaian politicians, but also among more established Ghanaians, like Ghana offers good economic opportunities and migrants should stay in Ghana and work there rather than try their luck elsewhere. So this emphasis on good and bad forms of migration can be seen as part of topographies of social and societal home, where the state and other actors distribute narratives of progress, of hope, of opportunities and development to different parts of the population. So when I started this research project, things in Ghana went very well. Now it's a big difference in terms of political and economic crisis, but it's still an ambivalent picture. So even though if there's a sense of crisis, it also goes hand in hand with economic wealth and progress just a few years ago. So especially from the middle of the 2000s and 2007, with the finding of oil in Ghanaian territorial waters, and when Ghana became a middle-income country in 2010, there was a lot of talk about the golden future in Ghana. And also growing wealth and very high growth rates. And this is very visible in Accra and all the major cities in Ghana, with a lot of big private cars, housing boom, consumer goods, luxury items. And you can see like houses are being built by this one here. And Ghanaian politicians and presidents talking about Ghana as an African tiger, about the lion economy, because of the finding of oil and with an emphasis on education. In 2008, when I did another research project in Ghana, I followed a Ghanaian politician in his hometown, and we went to different schools, and one of the things he told the pupils were that you can become an ambassador on astronaut because we have found oil, you study hard and pray. So these kind of quotes and talks and narrative can be seen as a way of trying to create and distribute social and societal hope. So while wealth and growth is very visible in Ghanaian society, not only in capital but also elsewhere, it's not accessible for all. And there's a lot of growing inequality in Ghana, and there's also a lot of frustrations and dissatisfactions and disillusion among disadvantaged parts of the population, not least young unemployed youth who find themselves in a situation where they cannot live their life they would like to, and where they cannot access this wealth and growth that they can actually see. And that can then lead to an understanding that high-risk migration or even other kinds of migration as a livelihood when all alternatives are seen as lacking or undesirable, but also as a way of connecting with the world, as my colleague Hans Schultz has said. And this sense of migration as reconnecting or connecting with the world and access in wealth was very visible in this town where I did field work, and which I here call a mantra. It's not called that, but an anonymization. It's a rural district capital in the Brongahafa region in western Ghana. I spent have been there three times, altogether 7 months since February 2012, and the latest in March this year, where I've been doing observation, hanging out, and participant photography, and lots of the photos you see here taken by informants, and done a lot of interviews. So I've been talking to at least 15 male and one female deputy from North Africa, mainly Libya, but also other North African and Middle Eastern countries in Europe. About 50 returnees from Libya because of the civil war. And then a lot of family members, local and traditional political authorities, NGO people, the IOM, and Ghanaian Immigration Service, etc. So Amanfo as a town is a rural place, as I said. It's relatively quiet. There are about 30,000 inhabitants, and it's estimated that about 10 to 15% of those are immigrants. So that also means that most households have one or more family members who is a migrant. The town is dominating by farming and feeder trade and international migration, which dates back to the 60s. And almost everybody there wants to travel, at least that's the feeling you get. And when you walk around town, the difference in housing, for instance, is very striking. So there are the old houses, which you can see up there, and the new houses, which you will see there. And most of these new houses are built by migrant money. There are also a lot of references to different places, like the New York hardware store, Benghazi Bar, Oxford International Private School, or the Stamford Bridge Cinema and Bar, which you can also see there. And this town is one of the hubs for overland migration to Libya for at least 3 decades. Where primarily young, but also not so young men, go to Libya through the Sahara to earn money for themselves and support their families, and sometimes onwards to Europe. So it's a lot of stepwise and recurring livelihood migration. Amanfo is even sometimes called the Libyan embassy in Ghana. It's quite well known, this migration. There has been, not so much any longer, but previously a booming connection man business for people to take migrants to Libya. Overland migration is well known to be very dangerous. There are thugs. Kidnapping is very useful. There are assaults, rape, road accidents, detention, deportation. So the list of hazards is really quite long, and many people die on the route or suffer. And this is, as I said, well known. It's not articulated as adventure or made bravery. It's hard to do this. But nevertheless, money can be made in Libya. And I should maybe just say briefly that this has changed with the situation in Libya, but people are actually still going and wanting to go. So this has at least two consequences. And one is that wealth from international migration is very visible there, houses, cars, education, etc. And then that the migration generates social hope. The other is an involuntary return. And deportation from Libya and other countries is also quite usual. But still the deputies are involuntary. Return migrants are blamed as having brought it on themselves. And it leads to a certain kind of conundrum that these individual migrants are blamed for their failure, even though the people know, widely know, the risk and dangers. But in spite of this, as I said, most people in Amanfo dream of traveling outside, especially low-skilled young men of poor backgrounds, who often school dropouts, whom I talked to in relation to this project. Many of them had been to Libya, dreamed of going there again, or going onwards to Europe or Israel, to be able to support their families, but also to establish their own futures by making some savings. And when I asked these young guys what their hopes for the future were, they presented the same, consistently presented the same vision of a good life to me, which was to have a house and to be then independent from the rules of a landlord, to have a steady income, to own a car and to be able to send the children to good schools. And then he explained to me that to be able to realize this, international migration was a necessity. I then asked a group of deputies to do participant photography, and you can see some of the results here, to take photos of the things that they liked and disliked in Amanfo and when they dreamed, what they dreamed about. And they also, all of them, took photos of cars and nice houses. So in one way, these hopes or dreams for a prosperous and comfortable lifestyle futures can be seen as a way of reaching out to wealth and modernity, seemingly without questioning the overall political and economic structures. And it could also easily be seen as an expression of consumerism and what has been termed what consumerism and an increasingly universal middle class lifestyle. Well, Thompson has called the privatization of hope in relation to economic reductionism in consumer capitalist form. But I would say it's more complicated than this. First of all, because it makes perfect sense to dream about houses and cars if you live in this place and if you don't have it already. A lot of people live in small rented rooms and transport without your own car is very uncomfortable and also quite dangerous. Moreover, to have money and material resources also enable people to invest in social relations and in this way also to engage in long-term patterns of reciprocity, which is necessary if there's not a welfare state. And then second, cars and houses not only constitute material goods and comfort, but they are also seen as representing security and autonomy for the individual and his or her family. Not only were cars meant to be used as cars for people themselves, but also to serve as taxis and in this way to rent an income. Houses could be lived in, but also could be used for renting out and then again granting an income. So achieving those things, yes, it's both related to prestige and comfort, but it's also a way of securing a future for yourself and your family and a way of managing uncertainty. So this shows the tension between the societal hope distributed by the governments and main political and parties linking education, oil and future prosperity, where hope is seen as something taking place in Ghana and you should stay there to obtain it, and for people in Amanfo who don't see this as viable and realistic for themselves. So rather they see hope as something which must be found elsewhere and through other means, other topographies of hope, in other words. So I'm now going to present one of the stories of the deputies I met. He's called Kwaku, a man in his 30s, who I met just after he was deported. He was poor and unemployed, and when the first time I talked to him, he explained to me, "I want to be a burger, you know, Canada burger. I want to be a burger because they do things. They build houses, they drive their cars, big, big cars." So burger has nothing to do with a whopper or hamburger, but it's a pidgin English term which in Ghana refers to successful migrants, or at least to migrants who have appeared such through sending remittances, presents, driving big cars, etc. from their country of settlement to Ghana. And the term dates back to Ghanaian migration to Hamburg in the 80s, so that's probably where this burger thing comes from. And this is seen as an attractive and prestigious position in some migrants in the communities in Ghana, but less in Accra and other places. So for people like Kwaku, this deportee who couldn't find work, who couldn't support his family and who dreamed about making fast money, he wanted to be a burger. And he tried to. When I met him, he had just returned, been deported from Libya, as I said. And his story was that he lived in a small place in a small village outside Amanfo. He had never gone very much to school, and he had difficulties in taking care and supporting his family. So he borrowed money from the bank, pretending he wanted to start a business, and then he left the village an early morning with three friends going to Libya. And he knew this would be dangerous and difficult, but he hadn't quite imagined how so. Because his journey did not go well. First he was kidnapped and beaten in the borderland between Niger and Libya by Fox and kept hostage for about 3 weeks until somebody paid ransom for him. Then in Libya he was detained by Libyan authorities and spent several weeks in Libyan prison where he thought he would die, until he and maybe 500 other sub-Saharan Africans were deported to Agadez in Libya on trucks, so they were basically put on trucks, driven back through the desert and left there to survive by their own means. And these kind of mass overland deportations are several examples of this taking place. So in Agadez he was totally broke and had to collect money on the street before he was able to make it back to Ghana, where the debt and the shame of returning empty-handed awaited him. So just 2 months after he had left, he was back in the village. And he explained to me, when I asked him about this, how he felt. "We did not feel happy because there was nothing in our pocket, and there are no jobs here, so we were not feeling lucky. My family was not feeling well either, they were not feeling well. Even the little money that I had lost it. And for who now, when I, at the time when I met him, suffered from insomnia, worried sick about how to pay for his debt and how to support his family and his future. And likewise, he had to face ridicule from townspeople who laughed about his ill-fated journey. So he spent most of his time hiding, as he said, in his room that he shared with his wife and children, only eating once or twice a day. And his story is not unusual for deportees, though he was arguably unlucky. And it demonstrates how the social hope underpinning his migration had turned into to hopelessness and shame, and at least temporarily suspending hope, not only for himself, but also for his family, and maybe for his surrounding, because it demonstrates the volatility of this migration strategy. And it's well known that many migrants don't tell about degrading life and working conditions to their family and community members, who often don't inquire about them. And such an economy of appearance, as Jennifer Cole has termed it, makes it possible to uphold this kind of burger status or migrant status through collaborative silences about disgraceful or even shameful conditions and activities abroad. But this is destroyed effectively when migrants return empty-handed for everybody to see that it doesn't work out. And this shame may be further aggravated because of the collective forms of migration in terms of sometimes financing the journey or the expectations from family members to benefit from it. So it's not only the social repositioning of the migrant which has failed, but that of the whole family. So deportation demonstrates how social hope can turn into social hopelessness, so to speak. Or in other words, that the potentiality of hope may easily evaporate and leave only uncertainty. So while Waku was caught and deported before starting work, others have lived longer time abroad and saved money for longer periods of time, and their stories were often different. So another person, whom I hear called Pastor Emmanuel, had another story. He was a pastor and farmer in Amanfo and a second-time deportee. And he had worked in several European countries before he was deported from Norway about 10 years ago. Doing farm work in Norway and keeping his expenses to a minimum, he had managed to save altogether about $20,000 that he had sent back to Amanfo to an entrusted friend who had bought land for him. So when he came back, he actually had something and he had some money. So when I So when I asked him how he felt about this second deportation, he explained it like this. I was feeling happy here. The majority of people thought my goods were on the way coming. They thought that because I'm looking fine. If you come home like that, people know that you are a traveler and they will come for you for advice. Even the ladies know that you speak more than two languages. They like that, yeah. You're a hustler, you're a traveler. They will be chasing you here and there. So in contrast to Baku's story, Pastor Emmanuel's account highlights success and admiration. He came back with money and what he called, or people generally called, exposure. And people thought that his belonging from Europe would be on their way because of his appearance and the fact that he had brought some money with him. And likewise, he described his migration as a kind of transformational experience where he had learned several European languages and got exposure and experience that he now uses to give advice to people in relation to traveling, but also in relation to other important life choices. Finally, he emphasized how he was chased and admired by the ladies, so he was also quick to emphasize that he only has time for his wife. So though he didn't use the term himself, he certainly positioned himself as an admired and big man, a burgher in a way, with moral authority. And his story shows how international migration can be an avenue of achievement in relation to prosperity and to being respected, even in regular situations followed by deportation. But Pastor Emmanuel didn't encourage prospective migrants and deportees in Amanfo to follow his example. Quite on the contrary, he told them to stay and seek their fortune in Ghana through education, prayers, and hard work. So much in line with the official distribution of hope in Ghana, if you want. He and a number of other people in Amanfo, usually people in elite or middle class positions or relatively well-off, were part of what we termed a safe migration position, or when more organized, a safe migration industry, or even sometimes an anti-illegal migration industry, consisting of persons, NGOs, and institutions who promote safe and legal migration through information campaigns, educational projects, or advice, often funded by Western countries, the EU, or IOM, or other international organizations. So safe migration proponents articulate a sedentary lifestyle as a better, safer, and sometimes more superior choice in contrast to the risk of irregular migration. And this development goes hand in hand with a change of the burgher position. So while burghers were generally respected and admired in Amanfo, it was another story in Accra and other major cities. I was explained by Kwame, the brother of a deputy. He said to me, "Accra doesn't have any regard for burghers," he said. "There are people there who live big lives without ever having traveled outside Ghana, so they don't respect burghers at all." And Kwame himself, he had traveled no further to a neighboring country, but he had landed a very good job in Amanfo, a government job. He drove a nice car, he stayed in a nice house, so he had in many ways realized this burgher position in a way without going through the desert. And stories like that, he explained to me, they're starting to change the burgher status even in a place like Amanfo. So he further explained, "We who have lived in the system for a while, we are able to sustain ourselves economically for a long time. But when burghers come home, they're not able to do that, yeah, because some want to show off, and before they know it, their few thousand of euros or dollars are gone, yeah, and they get a bit miserable." So according to Kwame, to this guy, the disenchantment of the burgher position is based on the growing wealth and opportunities for living big lives in Ghana, meaning that the burghers' demonstration and sometimes squandering of money is no longer seen as exceptional or as respectable. So even in Amanfo, persons like Kwame, who had lived in the system for a while, as I said, were doing better, being able to sustain themselves, rather than spending all the money at once and then leave them broke and miserable. Likewise, other people talk about the people in Amanfu and Ghana more generally were losing interest in burghers and that the position was not so respectful any longer. So to conclude, deputee status depends on achievement and resource mobilization. You can return as a deputee and become a big man if you manage to return with money or things, or have got, or seen as having exposure and experience, like Pastor Emmanuel. But most deputies return empty-handed and face difficulties, shame, ridicule, often the same, or very often even worse economic conditions than before, such as debt. And here Kwaku is an example. So this indicates a high degree of individualization of success and failure, which ignores the structural constraints that migrants, especially migrants in irregular situation, face en route or in the country of residence. So success and failure are subsumed to a question of individual discipline and perhaps also of luck and destiny. And on a more analytical level, we can say that this way of dealing with deportation maintains the social, the collective hope of migration as a path to a better, more prosperous and more autonomous and secure life for the migrants and his or her family. In a situation with few alternatives or few desirable or convincing alternatives. So it's a way of clinging to hope for a better future in a way. And it also shows a tension or discrepancy between the official distributions of hope in Ghana and the local ones. So there are the safe migration proponents and industry in the state, and politicians more generally, who are in favor of a sedentary lifestyle and against irregular migration, where the good future is located in Ghana and the means to realize the good future also are located in Ghana. And higher risk migration is seen as ignorant or irresponsible or perhaps even immoral. And then on the other hand, there are the local social topography is hope with expectation from families, local communities and migrants themselves, which are also often seen as only being able, primarily being able to be fulfilled via migration in this area, where the means to realize the good life of future are seen as available in Ghana. So with this, thank you very much.
Thank you.